You're listening to the BibleChallenge.org Old Testament Studies. For more information, go to stpeterslakemary.org. Now here's the Reverend Charles Holt.
The purpose of the book of Judges was to make an apology or a defense of the Jewish monarchy. The book divides into three main sections. It starts with faltering conquests and then goes to cycles and decline under the ruling of the judges. And then it ultimately ends with Israel imploding on itself. Anarchy and depravity take over. And you have this line that gets repeated in those last chapters of the book of Judges. It's in the sidebar on page 102. In those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So the book begins with faltering conquests in chapters 1 through 3. And at first it gives a fairly positive account of how the conquest's going, and you think, well, maybe we're plugging right along, just like the book of Joshua. I mean, Joshua, the conquest was fairly successful. You had little hints in the book of Joshua of failures, where it would say things like, well, the tribe of Judah did not drive out the Jebusites, and they still live with us to this day in the city of Jerusalem. They did not drive out the Philistines that were in the hill country. They did not drive out. And those are kind of the throwaway lines throughout the book of Joshua. But when we get to the book of Judges and we get into these first three chapters, it's actually those little lines that were in Joshua that are the big problems and start the big challenges for the nation. And it's a very important lesson for us as individuals, is that it's sometimes not the starting of something that is the challenge. We can take the step of faith and start to go on a journey with God and begin to build or work towards what He's calling us to. It's the other side, the finishing of it, the enduring, the persevering all the way to the end, that is the critical component to faithfulness. You can't just be mostly faithful. You have to be all the way faithful. And that in a sense is one of the main points to this first section in the book of Judges. And over again, we hear about the lack of being able to conquer the people in the land. Let me just give you a sense of that. When you look at Judges chapter 1, verse 28, when Israel grew strong, they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but did not drive them out completely. Ephraim did not drive out the Canaanites who lived in Gezer, and so the Canaanites lived in Gezer among them. Zebulun did not drive out the inhabitants of Kitron or the inhabitants of Naholal, so the Canaanites lived among them, but became subject to forced labor, and on and on and on. The 12 tribes failed to drive out the inhabitants, and it was those very inhabitants that will cause them problems. They were called a thorn in Israel's side and a snare to entrap them into idolatry. The Lord would use these inhabitants to be the means in which He would bring consequences to the nation of Israel. One of the main problems of this generation, and the book of Judges deals with the generation that comes after Joshua and that generation that entered into the promised land. It's their descendants, their children that are during the period of the Judges. And it identifies, and this is on page 103 in the middle of your handout, that the generation after them did not know the Lord or the work that He had done for Israel. It's one thing to know about the Lord, but if you don't know the Lord personally, you're at risk of faltering and failing in your relationship. And one of the most important things that any generation of followers of God have to be attentive to is the issue of succession and making sure that our children know the Lord. Not just know about the Lord, but know Him personally. have an intimate relationship with Him. This is absolutely critically important. So as the book of Judges progresses, what we end up in the midsection, and this is the bulk of the book, is a cycle where you have a measure of peace and rest in the land is the term. We have rest in the land where Israel is serving the Lord. But then Israel will do evil in the eyes of the Lord. They get ensnared into idolatry through intermarriage with the Canaanites and the Philistines and so on. And they do evil in the eyes of the Lord. God begins to discipline them by giving them into the hands of their enemies. They cry out for deliverance to the Lord. God raises up a judge to bring them salvation. And then Israel is then subsequently delivered. But then they fall back into the sin again. And this cycle repeats itself over and over again. It's the sin deliverance cycle of the book of Judges. And it starts off that things are going pretty well with the beginning judges. But it's the latter judges, the second half of the middle section, that you begin to see that these judges actually aren't working out so well. Again, remember the whole purpose of the book of Judges is to make the case that Israel, what they really need is a king. The judges are inadequate for the administration of the people of God. That what they really need is a king so that they will do what is right in Yahweh's eyes. The main problem for the Israelites is idolatry. They get all into Baal worship. And I shared with you last week some of the seediness of Canaanite Baal worship. It was grotesque, actually, but it was very perverse and a very sexualized idolatry. Baal and Ashtoreth were sort of these lovers in the heavenly realms, and part of what the gods Baal and Ashtoreth demanded was both temple prostitution and child sacrifice. And it was the ecstasy of these offerings that got these gods moving, so to speak. I'm trying to be careful in my language. But got them going so that fertility would happen in terms of crops and childbearing. And so the Canaanites were very much into this kind of cultic practices and worship of Baal and Ashtoreth. And as the Israelites intermarried with these tribes that they left in the land and failed to drive out, they began to adopt and adapt to Canaanite worship practices, bringing idols into their homes, the intermarriage of Canaanite women, children started to be sacrificed to these false gods. You started to have temple prostitution taking place among Israelites. So all of this led to corruption, judgment on the part of God, the people crying out, and then ultimately deliverance. We have two great stories of the judges in chapter 3 and 4 and 5. One is of a great warrior judge named Ehud, who entertains us because he's the left-handed judge who kills the obese King Eglon, and his sword goes into his belly and he can't pull his sword out. Then we also have the positive judge Deborah, who serves as an example to the warrior women of Israel. See, the men and the women of Israel are called to be warriors. You're called to be like Ehud and Deborah. To this day, you go to Israel, and there's all these women, young girls, that are walking around with assault rifles all over Israel. They're warrior people, warrior women. You don't mess with them. None of them. I mean, it's amazing. Every single man and woman, as they hit age, I think 18 or 19, have to do service in the Israeli military. Every single one of them. And they're all trained to be warriors. But that's what they were called to be back then. Warrior people who fight the battles with God leading the charge. What you begin to see, though, is that in Israel, this kind of lack of confidence and fearfulness manifest in the character of Gideon. Gideon comes from a family of Baal worshippers, and the emphasis on the story is on his fear and Yahweh's provision in spite of it. He used this weak, fearful man from a small tribe to manifest his strength as the divine warrior and the divine deliverer. And Gideon expresses his inadequacy to Yahweh. I am the least of the tribes of Israel, and I am the weakest of that tribe. And yet Yahweh displays his power. He calls Gideon to rally a force of 300 men who lap water like a dog, and uses those very weak, dog-lapping Israelites to rout the rulers of the foreign enemies of Israel. Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, "Rule over us, you and your son and your grandson also, for you have saved us from the hand of Midian." Gideon said to them, "I will not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you." This is a critical statement in the book of Judges. Israel is trying to make a man a king. Okay? But they're making the wrong guy their king. Gideon is a weakling. He's not supposed to be the king of Israel. This is not God's choice for their king. And yet, the Israelites aren't listening to the voice of God. They don't know Yahweh. They're not paying attention to what he's doing. Gideon rightly tells them, "I'm not the one that's supposed to be your king. Yahweh is your king." And yet, nevertheless, as Gideon has children, they make one of his children their king, Abimelech. And it's an utter failure, utter disaster in doing that. He is corrupt and evil, and those words of Gideon serve as an interpretive commentary on chapter 9 of the book of Judges. They say, "You come and reign over us." And in accepting that inappropriate leadership, the cedars of Lebanon have set themselves up to be burned in the fire. It's what chapter 9, verse 15 says. And that's exactly what happens. Judgment from God on the nation of Israel for choosing an evil person to be their king. As the book of Judges progresses, you have a series of what we would call minor judges. Basically, it just says they reigned, and you don't see any story of their conquest or anything like that. But what's noteworthy is what the text doesn't say about these judges. It doesn't say that there is any rest in the land. Remember the cycle, as the judge delivers, then it says, "And Israel rested from its enemies," and there was rest in the land. As you get after Gideon, you never hear that word ever again. That's an aspect of the cycle that stops. There'll be another aspect of the cycle that will stop. Israel will cry out to Yahweh, and Yahweh will go, "No, I'm done with you. I'm not going to rescue you anymore. You keep going to these false gods, let them rescue you. You think Baal and Ashtoreth are so great? Cry out to them. See if they'll save you." And God begins to stop this cycle in very dramatic ways by stopping giving Israel rest, stopping his deliverance of them. But we do have two final judges that serve to, one, show the compassion of God in any continuing to rescue Israel, but also the revelation that these judges really aren't the answer. And the first is in Jephthah. Number one, he's an illegitimate child and he's an outcast. He was a son of a prostitute, banished from his family. And yet God is going to use this son of a prostitute to be the savior of Israel in their time of need. He admirably fights against the Ammonite king. You'll remember from Deuteronomy and the beginnings of Joshua that there was 2.5 tribes that took the land to the east of the River Jordan. Remember that? And that land was Ammonite and Moabite land. And the Israelites had said when they got up to the Promised Land, can you give us safe passage? That's what they asked for. Can you just let us through? And neither one of those kings would let them through. And so Moses said, well, we're going to make a pathway here, and they conquered that land. And so this is the dispute that the Ammonite king is bringing up. He's talking about the land east of the Jordan, and he says, okay, I want it back. I want the land back. And the Israelite judge, Jephthah, goes out to him and says, let me tell you a little bit of the story and the history of this. We asked for safe passage back, you know, a couple hundred years ago. You didn't give it to us. So we came and we just took it. And it's been several hundred years now. We've been living in this land peacefully. What's the big deal that you're coming for the land again now? And, you know, the Ammonite king says, well, don't confuse the matters with the facts, all right? We're coming back. We want the land back. And Jephthah says, well, let's let the Lord be the judge between us. We'll let Yahweh sort this out. We'll have a fight. Whoever wins gets it. Yeah? So they go to war. At the beginning of the battle, though, Jephthah makes a very rash vow to the Lord. And here we see the weakness of this judge. He makes a vow that, Lord, if you will give the battle into my hands, whoever comes through the door of my house next will be dedicated to you as a burnt offering. Now that is repugnant to Israelites, that they would vow human sacrifice. That's Baal Ashtoreth kind of worship. But it just goes, I mean, we're starting to see the breakdown of Israelite understanding in Israelite society in these judges. And of course, Yahweh gives, I mean, that land belongs to the Israelites. He gives them the battle. But then we have this rash vow that we've got to deal with. And the text, you know, when it's his daughter that comes out, and he says, well, I made this vow. I mean, it was his only child. That's what it says. It's his only daughter. Well, I've got to sacrifice you as a burnt offering to the Lord. And she says, well, let it be as you say, and just give me a couple of months to go grieve the loss of my virginity, or the fact that I will never marry. So she goes and grieves with her friends for 2 months that she's never going to marry. And then we don't really have the rest of the story. Was she sacrificed? Was she not? Probably was. Oh, yeah, oh, she was. It's just not graphically described. Yeah. So the next place where we see the breakdown of society is the inner fighting that begins to take place when Ephraim comes and challenges Jephthah and says, you didn't include us in the battle. Yeah, I asked you to come and fight, but you didn't fight. And so you start to have this inner fighting that is taking place within the tribes. It's going to reach ahead at the end of the book of Judges. You have more minor judges in chapter 12, 8 through 15. And then you get to Samson. And it's under the rule of Samson that the Israelites had become complacent in their exile. One of the interesting things that's at the beginning of the story of the book of Samson is the Israelites are under the bondage of the Philistines, but no longer are they crying out. You know, remember that's part of the cycle, the book of Judges, that they get disciplined and then they cry out under the discipline to the Lord, and then the Lord raises up a deliverer. There's no crying out. In fact, when the deliverer comes, who is Samson, and he begins to fight the Philistines, they ask him, "Why are you fighting them? They're our rulers." Really? I mean, is this how bad it's gotten? That you don't even think that your bondage is a bondage? That you're complacent under tyranny? And this is the part of the judgment of this whole section of the book of Judges. And yet, nevertheless, God raises up Samson as a symbol of the salvation that comes with godliness. And his parents were godly. And the example of their vows to the Lord, and God speaks to them, and they respond with obedience. Samson is offered up as a Nazarite, meaning that he is to keep his vows and promises to the Lord. But what we see as the story of Samson unfolds is that when he keeps his vow, he's victorious. But when he allows women, I don't know what the problem with women is in the Old Testament. Always the problem. It's actually not the women, though, is it? It's the men. It's the weakness of the men. Yeah, it's unbelieving women. It's seduction. I mean, there's two ways that people go apostate. One is out of fear of their enemies from persecution and oppression. And the second is by seduction. Right?
I'm going to mention about the menstrual offering and seduction as it represents wisdom. Because these three proverbs are all the scriptures that speak on wisdom and always refer to women as being seductive. So the Bible is warning you off. Everybody knows what a seductive woman is and what she does. So it's guard yourself against wisdom and not be seduced to the things of the world.
Sure.
Refer to an actual physical woman, but the difference between wisdom and non-wisdom.
Sure. Yeah, there is that theme throughout the scriptures of the seductiveness of the wisdom of the world. I think what's happening here is actual physical seduction. I mean, this is not, I don't think this is spiritualized, actually. This is actually what the problem was with the leaving these tribes in the land, is that they seduced Israel into following their practices, and it was intermarriage with foreign women who were part of the problem. Now, here's an interesting distinction, and we'll see this when we get to the book of Ruth. It's actually not that they were foreigners that was the problem. It's that they were foreign idolaters. Foreign women who are faithful to Yahweh are okay. What the real heart of the problem is the idolatry. And it's actually the idolatry that is seductive. It's the idolatry that's seductive. It's the idea that the work of our hands could give us wealth and fertility and blessing. That the fruit of our womb would be what gives us fertility and blessing. So we sacrifice our children. We give up our sexual purity. And it only leads ultimately to the third section in the book of Judges, which is the anarchy and depravity in the book. Yeah, Marisol.
Would the woman allowed to marry the men? I don't know. Keep saying the men marry the women.
Yeah.
The women also
marry
the men and they
prefer? Back during that time, I mean, you're kind of thinking in a 21st century way of looking at things. But it was a patriarchal society, and by that meaning father rule. So the initiator of relationships was often the man, but even more than that, it was sometimes the father and the parents who set up marriages. So are there examples of where women initiate the relationships in the scriptures? I'd have to think about it. I think the book of...
Oh no,
that went both ways. Jewish men were marrying Canaanite women, and Canaanite men were marrying Jewish women. Yeah, it was
allowing the Jewish family though. They were letting
Yeah. Sure. Because and here's the issue of patriarchy and the fatherhood, because if those Canaanite families had money to give to an Israelite family to pay for that woman, yeah, they would accept that. You know, they want the money. Or they want the power that comes with being associated with that family or whatever, the prestige. Or, you know, there's in marriage, there's all that stuff wrapped up. Money, power, prestige, all of these things. Yeah, so they, you know, there's a lot involved. It's not just about, you know, marriage. It's about lusting after all of those things. And they, if you want to live like the other nations live, and you go after that and you covet that, it's ultimately going to have consequences. That's the message of the book of Judges.
Ruth and Tamar, they initiate it.
Yes.
Well, Ruth. Naomi initiates it,
but here, yes, they initiate it, but let me keep going, and we'll get to Ruth in a minute, okay? I got to keep pressing on. We're running out of time. The last section of the book of Judges is where it ends in total anarchy and depravity. You have this steady refrain coming again and again. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And the first place where things start coming off the rails is with the man named Micah. And he is a man who sets up his own personal shrine in his house, and he takes his wealth and turns it into a big house, a big thing of false gods. And then a Levite comes along and he sets him up as his own personal priest to minister to all of his false gods.
I guess then the Levite was corrupted too, because
absolutely. Yeah, the nobody's looking good in this whole section, okay? This is one of the worst parts of the... This is one of the ugliest sections in Scripture. And the book of the writer of the book of Judges is letting the reader make all the moral judgments, okay? So that's one thing that you need to understand. What he's going to keep saying over and over again is, these are the days when Israel had no king and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. He's just going to tell the story of the corruption and the depravity and let you, you know, interpret that all in light of the law of Moses. Levites were not supposed to serve household gods. Of course not. Micah is creating his own little kingdom to himself. That's the point. Micah's not a king unto himself. And as a result, it costs him his life. Next, you have another Levite. So what we have a common theme here of corruption in the Levitical priesthood. The next scene demonstrates anarchy without kingly rule, and it's to be compared to the account of Sodom and Gomorrah from the book of Genesis. And remember the story of Lot and Sodom and Gomorrah and the violent rape murder that takes place in this section in chapter 19 is to illustrate just how depraved the Levites and certain tribes, particularly the tribe of Benjamin, had become without Yahweh's kingly rule. The shocking thing is that we have Sodom and Gomorrah within Israel. That's the shocking thing that is, you know, in the face of the reader. And all who saw it said, such a thing has never happened or has been seen from the day that the people of Israel came up out of the land of Egypt. And until this day, consider it, take counsel, and speak. what happened. You know, this Levite and a concubine are attacked by these men, Benjamites from the city, and they rape her. They rape the concubine. The man who was providing the hospitality for the Levite, who was murdered as well, ends up, they chop up the pieces of this woman and mail them to the 12 tribes of Israel. I mean, you're supposed to read that and go, yeah, you probably did. You're like, what? That's Israel? And that's what the writer says. You know, everybody was saying, never has such a thing ever been done in Israel like this. Never even heard of something like this. There's an interesting passage in the prophet Isaiah where it says, if the Lord of hosts had not left us a few survivors, we should have been like Sodom and become like Gomorrah. That if the Lord, you know, when he takes the reins off and he allows the salt to lose its saltiness, it just degenerates. But thankfully, and this is the point of the prophet Isaiah, God always preserves his righteous remnant. And from there he can bring things back. But if the Lord hadn't left the righteous remnant, then it would have completely degenerated to Sodom and Gomorrah, and ultimately the end of Sodom and Gomorrah, which was total annihilation in judgment. And that's where we end up going. Instead of Sodom and Gomorrah being totally annihilated, what we're talking about is annihilating an entire tribe of one of the 12 tribes of Israel, Benjamin. And Israel unites, and after this, you know, the mailing of the body parts to the 12 tribes, they all come together. Some interesting things, instead of 600,000 men, it's only 400,000. Things have shrunk. Things are degenerating. They come together not to make war against common pagan enemy, but against each other, to wipe out one of the tribes. I mean, this is anarchy. It's self-destructive behavior. And then as they are having their own mercy on the tribe of Benjamin in the last chapter, they don't inquire of Yahweh on how to preserve Benjamin at all. They just come up with their own human solutions. Oh, we'll find you some women over here, and we got some other ideas of how to get some women. We'll put Benjamin back together. And the book of Judges ends with, these are the days when Israel had no king, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That's the message. Total societal breakdown if you don't keep Yahweh as your king and do what is right in Yahweh's eyes. You got the message?
Thanks for listening. For more information, check out stpeterslakemary.org.